This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Karen Frost Arnold. Karen is associate professor of philosophy at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and also visiting associate professor at the African Center for Epistemology and Philosophy of Science at the University of Johannesburg. She works centrally in the area of social epistemology, feminist philosophy, and philosophy of science. But one unifying theme of her research is the philosophy of the internet. Her new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled, Who Should We Be Online? A Social Epistemology for the Internet. Now, I suppose that it goes without saying that the internet plays a central role in how we communicate, how we share information, how we disseminate ideas, how we maintain our social connections, and even conduct business. I also suppose that it goes without saying that the internet exacerbates existing problems regarding irrationality, bias, wrongful discrimination, forms of exploitation and dehumanization. But the internet also gives rise to new ethical and epistemological problems. I'm thinking here of fake news, the phenomenon of sock puppetry, various kinds of hoaxes that are made possible by the internet, and various forms of disinformation that also seem to be made possible by the internet. So, in Who Should We Be Online? Karen Frost Arnold proposes a multi-layered social epistemology designed to assist us in navigating the fraught moral epistemic landscape of the online world. Along the way, she develops a framework for thinking about how we should go about investigating the normative questions that are posed by the internet. Now, as usual, there's a whole lot to talk about, a lot of good philosophical questions afoot. But as we usually begin, why don't we begin with our guest? Hello, Karen.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you too. I really, really enjoyed the book. But before we get to the book, you know, we begin these episodes with the author saying some things about herself. Why don't you start us off that way? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Thanks. Well, I mean, might not be obvious from my accent, but I'm actually originally from Britain. All of my family is British, and I lived there till I was 12. When I was 12, we moved to California, and that's where I went to high school. I've lived in a bunch of different places in the U.S. I went to college just outside of Boston at Wellesley College. That's where I fell in love with philosophy. There's a really incredible intellectual community there and really supportive philosophy department. So that's where my love of philosophy started. after college, I went to grad school at the University of Pittsburgh. Fell in love with the Steelers and everything Pittsburgh, groundhogs and everything Pennsylvania. I also, when I was there, was taking a seminar on bioethics with Lisa Parker, and I read Annette Byers' Trust and Antitrust. And that's where my just, I mean, you could call it obsession with thinking about trust started. I really admire her work. And so I ended up, even though I went to grad school to work on philosophy of science, I managed to combine that. So I ended up writing my dissertation on trust in science. I actually finished up my dissertation while I was living outside of Pittsburgh in Las Vegas for 3 years, which was interesting. And after that, I moved to kind of the opposite place in the United States from Las Vegas. I now live in a tiny town in upstate New York, and I teach at Hobart and William Smith. And I'm also a visiting professor at the University of Johannesburg for the next 3 years, which is a really vibrant intellectual community that I'm really excited to be a part of. I live with my husband and two cats and a bunny.
And the bunny lives inside the house?
The bunny does live inside. The bunny is rescued from my neighbors who wanted to throw it away. So her name is Snuffles, and she lives in the house with us.
They are trainable animals, I'm to understand.
Yeah, she's fun. She's a little loaf. She's very funny.
That's wonderful. Can I ask you about Vegas? So I got married in Las Vegas.
You did.
And
that's awesome.
Las Vegas. I've never gambled, but Las Vegas always strikes me as a philosophically interesting place.
Oh my gosh, it's a fascinating. There's so many different types of people who live there. While we were there, it was one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. I mean, it was an interesting place to live. I also don't gamble, so when people would come to visit, they're like, "Oh, we know someone who lives in Vegas. We can come and party. It'll be amazing." And we would take them out for nice long hikes in the beautiful nature around. And so, I mean, there's so much to do there. But I think I sort of missed out on some of what's sort of typically Vegas because that's not really my thing. But it's a beautiful place with so many interesting people. I was really lucky to live there in many ways, but maybe not for me long term.
I can understand that. Last time I was there, I was observing people taking selfies in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Yes.
And I found myself wondering whether they were pretending to be in. What were they doing?
Oh,
were they,
you could do so many things.
They're not pretending to be in Paris, right? It's, I mean, the plaque on the for those who don't know, the plaque on the Eiffel Tower outside the Paris Hotel says in English Eiffel Tower.
It does.
So it's this is a philosophically interesting, like, so fake it's got its own realness to it, kind
of. Oh my gosh. Yes. It has its own world, its own aesthetic, its own sort of like facsimiles are the real. It's a very interesting place.
Well, this is a nice segue, I think, to talking about your book.
Yeah, just like the internet.
Maybe the internet is kind of is Vegas-like in this respect. So let's begin at the beginning. So the analysis you offer in Who Should We Be Online is informed by and applies, we even might say, a kind of general framework in social epistemology, or maybe a collection of frameworks, a conjunction of various social epistemic commitments. Together, they form an acronym, which I will allow you to pronounce. But can you tell us about the components of this social epistemic framework that that the book is organized around?
Yeah. So I call it the FOVIVI framework. So that's FOVIVI. I know it's not super catchy. But the idea here is what I wanted to do in the book was to sort of do proof of concept of a kind of a research program in what I call socially situated epistemology of the internet. So this approach really sort of recognizes that we're not just generic users of the internet. We're not what I call Cartesian cognizers with smartphones. We're embodied beings, we're raced, we're gendered, we're interacting with each other in the midst of various different systems of power and oppression. And so what I wanted to do in the book was to draw on a lot of really interesting interdisciplinary work in internet studies, and also draw on all of these rich tools that we have in social epistemology to do some applied epistemology. And so I wanted to say, okay, look, social epistemologists have developed some really useful tools and frameworks for thinking about us as knowers in our social context. So the Fovivi framework lays out five different sets of tools that philosophers have developed. So I'll just like say something about each of them. So the F and the O, those stands for feminist accounts of objectivity. So, right, feminists have long argued that objectivity is an important epistemic value, that there are things that we can do to reduce and manage bias, even though we probably can't eradicate it, right? So getting rid of bias, right, sexist bias, racist bias, is an important kind of epistemic goal. And there are actually things we can do, right? So I draw on the work of feminist empiricists like Helen Longino, and also feminist standpoint theorists like Sandra Harding, and also Kristen Intiman's combination of these two frameworks in what she calls feminist standpoint empiricism, right? So this approach argues that epistemic communities that center the voices of marginalized people are epistemically superior to communities that lack those voices or suppress them or don't pay attention to them. We can weed out biases from dominant traditions and assumptions if we include those voices and take their transformative criticisms and standpoints seriously. So that's one set of frameworks. So that's the first one. The first V is the second framework that stands for veritism. So I think that Alvin Goldman's veritistic systems oriented social epistemology is a really useful framework for thinking about the internet because it values truth, right? So on this consequentialist framework, we evaluate social practices and institutions by how well they enable people to form beliefs, and true beliefs is the goal, and weed out errors. So we can look at social practices and institutions and technological design features and ask, to what extent are they helping people form true beliefs? To what extent are they circulating errors or false beliefs? And I think this framework fits really well with feminist epistemology. Because, right, the feminist epistemologists have been arguing that epistemic communities that include the voices of marginalized people are better able to detect errors, to weed out false claims, and also to provide new truths that might add to our repertoire of true beliefs that we can use to understand the world. So veritism helps us answer questions like, how do our social practices of interacting together online, how do the ways that our social media platforms are set up, how do they help us form true beliefs? How do they spread ignorance? And so ignorance is actually the third framework. So that's the first I. So the epistemologies of ignorance literature is really useful because it helps us see that ignorance is not just sort of a passive absence of knowledge, but it's something that's actively produced and sustained. And this literature has really ballooned in recent years in ways that are really helpful because it helps us see sort of a multiple layers at which our knowledge practices actually produce and maintain ignorance. So we can think of our individual habits of willful ignorance, turning away from the truth. We can think of social practices. I find Charles Mills' work really helpful here in thinking about how that can sustain ignorance. We can think about institutional policies, right? As a philosopher of science, I'm really interested in corporate interests and how corporate agents can often manipulate science and spread ignorance. I think the climate science issues are really helpful here. So that's the I. The next V stands for virtue epistemology. So that's the fourth framework. So virtue epistemology draws our attention to our epistemic agency. So we can cultivate epistemic agents and we can think about what kind of a person do I want to be on the internet? And I think socially situated virtue epistemology is really helpful because it centers our attention on how our social location shapes the kinds of habits that we're likely to develop. And it gets us to think about feedback loops between our social structures and our epistemic virtues. So for the internet, we can think about, okay, how is this platform set up? How are people behaving on this platform? Am I being encouraged to develop certain kinds of epistemic vices? How can I push back against this? Or what kind of epistemic virtues are permitted or encouraged by our online technological design features that we're living with, and also our social habits on the internet. And then the last framework, that's the last I, stands for injustice. So here I'm thinking about the epistemic injustice literature that has really grown recently. So this literature draws our attention to the way in which injustice shapes a lot of our epistemic interactions. And there are many different ways that injustice epistemically harms marginalized people. And we see that all the time on the internet. We can think about the ways that online harassment which data shows disproportionately targets women, people of color, queer folks, right? That online harassment disproportionately silences people, excludes them from epistemic communities. We can think about how do we perpetrate testimonial injustice online. We can think about how does hermeneutical injustice operate online so that certain kinds of people's speech is misunderstood. And we can think about, to bring all sort of all of these frameworks together, what kinds of virtues and structural changes are needed to avoid epistemic injustice in ways so that the community can get access to truths that are going to help us form true beliefs and also weed out biases that are preventing us from really forming knowledge in objective ways. So those are the five frameworks that I bring together in the book.
That's fabulous. And I take it that there's, just to punctuate a point that you make throughout the book, there's a kind of urgency, I think, given that the data that we have now, particularly about Western developed democracies and the people who live in them, the extent to which people get their information. doing their own research and this sort of thing on the internet is kind of staggering when you think about it. So to think that, there are these, there's this relatively from the point of view of from the long run, this relatively new instrument in the broad sense that an unusually large number of people have very quickly turned to as their main way of being informed about the world, learning about things, connecting with other people. I say, well, if in that very medium there are new pitfalls and opportunities, theorizing all that seems all the more urgent. Does that sound right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I think it's also, this is something that, I really want to focus on more going forward in the book. It's not just in the West, right? All over the world, right? And we can think about the ways that our social platforms are damaging to democracies, the ways in which Facebook has allowed hate speech to really fuel genocides around the world, right? So I think that, there's lots of urgency to this, right? People's lives are being damaged through stuff that's happening online. And also our ability to understand the world and all of the many crises that we're dealing with right now is really affected by, as you said, this being a major tool for by which we come to understand ourselves and the world around us. Yeah, I really feel, in a way, I feel it's quite an overwhelming book instead of it used to think about, because there are so many very pressing problems to deal with. Yeah.
Well, great. Let's turn to one of them, and to the book addresses several distinct sites of sort of social epistemic normative concern. So you deploy the tools of the FOFIVI frameworks in thinking through a handful of normative problems that are posed by the online world. And where the book begins is with content moderation. I won't have been the only one in reading your book to have thought, when someone mentions content moderation, to instantly think of censorship and free speech and the marketplace of ideas stuff and all those good million sort of issues. And I have to say, it came as a bit of a revelation to me. I said, well, wait a minute. There's a whole other set of issues about the people doing the moderating. So part of the concern of your discussion of content moderation, maybe a large part of that concern, is with the epistemic labor of the people whose task it is, who are employed as the people who are looking at all of the objectionable content and, removing it. Can you tell us I'm glad to have read the book for lots of reasons, but recognizing that that this is part of the normative, this is part of what's at issue normatively in content moderation too, was a real benefit to me. Can you tell us a little bit about the analysis there?
Yeah, thanks. There's lots of really interesting stuff about the censorship issues here. But I think also if we turn and look at the work that these folks are doing, we're going to see we're actually in really an epistemically nightmarish situation here. So I really focus on commercial content moderators. So these are the folks who are working for Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, who, like you said, are making decisions decisions about what gets removed from the internet. They're often not working directly for these companies. They're working for sort of like subcontracting companies. And they are looking, like sifting through all of the content, videos, posts that have been reported as problematic or violating the social media platforms' terms of service or their community policies. And Sarah Roberts, who's really sort of the premier researcher on this issue, who drew a lot of people's attention to this, she describes this as kind of an assembly line kind of work that the social media companies have set up. So there are folks for the content from the United States is often being moderated by folks in the Philippines and India, right? So they're folks sitting in large office buildings in front of a computer for hours a day, just being fed an endless stream of the worst of the internet. And they have to make decisions. They're expected to do it very quickly about whether a post or a video should be deleted, removed, whether a user should be sanctioned for posting it, whether they should be suspended or removed from the platform. And they're doing this at extremely fast speeds. So there's a really wonderful, but it's very difficult to watch documentary called The Cleaners. And in that, that's about content moderators in the Philippines. One of the moderators talks about how the expectation is that he will look at 25,000 images a day. And this is the worst of the worst. Just as a heads up for you, I'm going to just give it a couple of sort of troubling examples. Just this week, a couple of days before I'm talking to you, there was an article that came out about a lawsuit that's being filed by some moderators from Kenya who were working for Facebook, at a subcontracting, working for Facebook. And I'll just read you a quote from what they were doing. Examples of the posts that they viewed on a daily basis include pictures and videos of people being raped, children being molested, and people being slaughtered or burnt alive. Some of them even saw their own relatives die on the platform. So these are folks who are being paid pennies to watch incredibly disturbing content. So the folks in Kenya were being paid $2.20 an hour. They did not have adequate counseling. Many of them developed symptoms of PTSD. So they're doing this work under really terrible conditions. And the social media companies are making billions of dollars, right, off of this labor. And you might say, okay, this is clearly a moral problem. This is really an ethical nightmare. But in the chapter, I also argue this is really an epistemic nightmare too. So it's relevant to epistemologists, because if you think about where the social epistemology literature has gone in recent years, we've really come to have a better understanding of how very difficult it is for us to understand each other, to understand exactly what it is that somebody's saying, to be able to come to know people who are different than us, to be able to fully appreciate different people's perspectives, right? So if we think about the epistemic injustice literature, we realize that there are all of these barriers that can prevent us from fully giving uptake to what people are saying or understanding their speech. So if we think about sort of this epistemological picture we get, where it's actually quite difficult to understand the world around us and interpret, say, pictures or interpret people's speech, and then contrast that with how the social media companies have set up their labor model, where they can expect people to make incredibly quick judgments about somebody's speech and determine whether it's hate speech or whether it's false or whether this video of something that's happening in the Syrian civil war is relevant or not, and to make these decisions really quickly. We can see that it's really an epistemic disaster here. So it's problematic for us as an online community that we have these very consequential decisions being made by folks who are often far removed from the communities whose content they're moderating, who they don't have the time to necessarily develop relationships with folks so that they can understand the content well. They don't necessarily have time to develop the relevant epistemic virtues that we've learned are important for avoiding things like testimonial injustice or hermeneutical injustice. So that's one set of problems. It's not well set up to provide reliable, objective moderation. Another problem that I talk about in the chapter is that the labor model of commercial content moderation perpetrates a particular kind of epistemic injustice against the moderators. So I call this epistemic dumping. So here, I find it really helpful to notice that a bunch of internet studies scholars, Sarah Roberts, Sarah Jung, often use metaphors of garbage and trash to talk about the content that the moderators are using right there, sorting through the trash of the internet, taking out the garbage. And I was thinking that epistemic communities also produce garbage or trash, right? So as we're producing knowledge together, if we're having a conversation or in my classroom, right, we might be trying to understand a text and we might sort of produce unwanted byproducts in our attempts to produce knowledge, right? We might sometimes come across a misinterpretation of a text, or we might develop a false belief in attempting to understand something. So that's what I'm calling epistemic trash. And epistemic trash is not all alike. Some of it is what I call toxic epistemic trash, right? So the kinds of false beliefs that are part of what Charles Mills calls white ignorance, right? Or the willful hermeneutical ignorance that Gail Poulhouse talks about. Mm-hmm. These are kinds of harmful types of epistemic trash. And so in the chapter, I argue that there's this kind of phenomenon of epistemic dumping that is happening online and also in other communities where there are disproportionately some groups who are tasked with sorting through the toxic epistemic trash of our communities, dealing with it, making decisions about how it should be handled. And there's often a lack of respect for their skills in handling toxic epistemic trash, making decisions, and also dismissive of the very labor that it takes. So we often exploit people's labor when we dump our epistemic trash on them. So one of the other examples, as I give, is often, you know, we can think about in our academic communities, right? Often marginalized faculty members are people of color or trans faculty are often the ones who are dealing with the aftermath of, say, an act of hate speech on campus, or somebody's right. teaching material in a racist or transphobic way, right? Often they're the ones who have to take out the epistemic trash and deal with these problems in our epistemic communities. So I think that dumping the trash of our online communities on moderators is problematic and maybe helps us think about some of the ways in which we are tending to dump our trash on some groups in other epistemic communities too.
Right. And I guess that, you know, maybe a related but distinct dimension of this is that the moderators, you know, one way to understand what they're doing is protecting us from something, right? And so that they're tasked with something that we would say is very vital to the health of our community, you know, sort of protecting us from those images and from you know, protecting the internet from becoming just that kind of cesspool, right? And then so that the working conditions, the epistemic conditions, that all of these are so depleted.
Yes, absolutely.
Seems like just this, another troubling aspect of this that maybe adds to, that adds to the badness of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the social media companies are not showing respect for the kinds of epistemic skills that are involved in the work that's being done here. And as you said, right. it's incredibly vital. It has really, learning about this has changed my relationship to the internet, right? So, I mean, I already think it's a cesspool and I'm not even seeing most of this stuff, right? And so right. my nice sort of sanitized version of the internet, I'm getting that at the expense of somebody else, often being quite traumatized by what they're being exposed to, working really hard to protect me from that, and really developing important epistemic skills that are we're as a society not respecting, not affording them the time and the resources to develop and be compensated for that epistemic labor.
Right. I don't think this comes up in the book, but you know, just a question that this mm-hmm. raises going to your to the second V, the virtue part. And this might be more of a question about virtue in the sort of more generic sense. I'm not sure whether this is a question about epistemic virtue as such or virtue in a mm-hmm. in a broader sort of broader characterological sense. Do we have any data about whether repeated exposure to the kind of imagery, the kind of material that moderators are by their work exposed to, you know, there's that thought in Aristotle that, you know, if you're exposed to virtuous people, that's part of, you know, seeing the courageous person be courageous is an essential part of developing the virtues. And similarly, you know, being exposed to the vices, you know, can, you know, can make your soul bad, you know? Okay. So I'm just wondering, like, do we have any data on, apart from the trauma, to say apart from it, I don't mean to diminish it, apart from the trauma, which is an important piece of this puzzle, does exposure to this kind of material, I guess I would expect it to have these sort of these side effects, you know, that make people doesn't only traumatize people, but makes them worse in other kinds of ways?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not aware of any specific data on that, although there are anecdotes that it very much destroys people's ability to trust other people, right?
Yeah,
So there are stories of content moderators being afraid to leave their children at home with folks, or Rosalind Bowden, who's a content moderator who was at a conference and shared this anecdote. She worked at MySpace for years, and she said after working at MySpace doing moderation, she didn't want to touch anybody. She didn't want to shake anybody's hand because she just learned how terrible people were, right? So it's not just like that as a kind of trauma, but like distrust of other people is one of the things that also makes us vulnerable to things like believing conspiracy theories, right? So I'm not aware of data of that, but profound distrust of other people and seeing the worst of them. I think that that would be a very interesting research question to see whether that affects their sort of epistemic capacities. Yeah.
It just keeps getting worse.
Yes.
So that's all very interesting. So the third chapter now, just moving on, mm-hmm. Begins with you know, a description of you know, at the time, an episode that I had heard of at the time, and then, you know, promptly, you know, sort of forgotten. But you know, an episode of online deception occurring during in 2011 during the Syrian uprising. Can you tell us a little bit about the deception, and then sort of run us through your analysis of I think a really important distinction that you draw between online sort of imposters and online tricksters. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So actually, this is the case that got me obsessed with epistemology of the internet. So I heard about this blog. It's called A Gay Girl in Damascus, and it purported to be written by Amina Araf, who was a Syrian-American lesbian living in Damascus in the midst of the Syrian uprising, right? So it's part of the Arab Spring. She's presenting herself as an activist who's involved in these circles. Partly because of state censorship, a lot of folks are reading this blog and interviewing Amina, like Western journalists, to try and learn about the Arab Spring and the uprising. So it's widely read in the US and in Europe and places like that. And one day on the blog, somebody posts saying that Amina had been kidnapped by the Assad regime. And so a lot of press and concerns about getting Amina released came up. And in sort of the aftermath of that, it was revealed that it was all a hoax, right? So the blog was actually written by Tom McMaster, who was an American living in Edinburgh at the time. And so I identify this McMaster as what I call an online imposter, right? So online imposters are folks who betray expectations of authenticity, right? Presenting yourself in an authentic way. And they do that in ways that risk harm to epistemic communities. And so I talk about all of the different kinds of harms that this imposter kind of exemplifies, right? So this connects to feminist accounts of objectivity, right? So objectivity is an important value. It's important to try and get reduce the kinds of biases that we're liable to in trying to understand world events like the Syrian uprising. And imposters can prevent us from engaging in some important practices of objectivity. So I argue that trust is really central to these practices of objectivity, right? The voices of marginalized people are really helpful for correcting biases, but they have to have trust in themselves that their voices and what they have to say is worth listening to. They also have to be trusted by other people. They have their voices and criticisms and concerns have to be listened to. And also, everybody has to have trust in the avenues through which their voices and their criticisms and concerns are being spread. And McMaster undermined all three types of trust that are really important for practices of objectivity. He spread a bunch of stereotypes about Middle Eastern women as being passive and unempowered, and presented Amina as this empowered American who was enlightening Syrian lesbians in really problematic ways. So he's spreading stereotypes, which can cast doubt and undermine the trust that folks have in those folks and in activists. And I think more sort of obviously, and something that if people were aware of at the time, is that this one case of this hoax really undermined people's trust in the internet, right? So everybody has started to say, well, okay, this one Middle Eastern activist was a hoax, but what about all of these other folks who we've been relying on for sort of on the ground information about the Arab Spring? And so it undermines people's trust in the very sort of like mechanisms by which we get to hear from voices who might otherwise not be listened to. So imposters can do significant epistemic harm. So in the chapter, I argue that trustworthiness is an important epistemic virtue. And we need to be careful about when we present ourselves in inauthentic ways on the internet. But that also really needs to be qualified, right? Because one of the wonderful things about the internet is it can be a space for play and for humor and for us to learn about ourselves. And also, as I argue, for really useful cases of trickery. So I define tricksters as folks who intentionally betray expectations of authenticity in epistemically virtuous acts of resistance. So there can be really useful ways in which sometimes we betray trust. And this I take back to Annette Beyer, right? She always argued that, you know, some types of trust shouldn't be lived up to. But sometimes betraying the trust of the exploiter is actually a virtuous act, right? Maria Lagunas has this beautiful quote where she says that there are some truths that only the fool can speak and only the trickster can play out without harm. So sometimes marginalized people can strategically use ignorance to trick privileged people into learning about their own biases and prejudice. And there are tons of really interesting activist hoaxes who, so use these terms like culture jamming or media activism, who folks who draw attention to issues that have been overlooked by engaging in online acts of trickery. So I use this example of the Yes Men, who are activists and performance artists. And they do engage in really interesting pranks where they create fake websites, create fake press releases to gain access to spaces, to pretend to be somebody they're not, and then draw attention to issues. So for example, in 2009, they perpetrated this really interesting hoax at the COP15 climate summit in Copenhagen, where they held this fake press conference with a fake Canadian government representative and a fake Ugandan government representative. And the Canadian government was announcing, we're going to dramatically reduce our climate emissions and we're going to start a program of climate reparations for vulnerable countries. And then the Yes Men created fake press releases. They got press to start reporting, oh, Canada's doing this. And they used fake Twitter accounts to spread this message. And when the hoax was revealed, it got more press attention. So the Yes Men think of what they're doing as sort of hacking the media system to bypass the ways in which often powerful state entities and corporate entities can kind of set the narrative, right? Can use their outsized power to prevent us from really talking about what's possible, right? So a lot of people who believed, oh gosh, the Canadian government is actually doing this, realize that it's possible for them to do this and that they're actively choosing not to. So there's a real sort of really interesting epistemic questions about when does sometimes trickery sort of betray our trust in ways that actually undermine the problematic exclusivity of our epistemic communities, that sometimes some messages are not heard and we can break through with trickery. And the sort of humor of the internet makes that really interesting in ways that can really draw attention to issues that I think are important. So that's sort of the distinction that I draw in that chapter.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, part of me in reading through that chapter, I was reminded of some data that I saw about the Colbert Report. Where, and again, I didn't follow up to see whether, you know, these data held up, but at the height of the Colbert Report's popularity, there was some reason to think that a non-negligible number of conservative viewers believed that Stephen Colbert was actually a conservative.
Excellent.
And that the trick was on the liberals because he was portraying the liberal caricature of what conservatives are.
That's fascinating. But
that he himself was actually that the man was actually a conservative, and the joke was on the liberals.
That's fascinating. I had not heard that. That's so interesting.
Right. And then just to think about how the Daily Show at its prime, when Stewart was the host, you know, again, a non-negligible number of people within a certain age group got their news from the Daily Show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can think of often the ways in which they often on the Daily Show and Colbert Report, they sort of tricked people into revealing truths that they wouldn't normally reveal sort of through like, those interviews. And that's epistemically fascinating to me.
Yeah. Very, 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 very interesting. So that distinction is very helpful in thinking about that. There was a when John Stewart was on, I guess it was on Firing Line, or was it Firing Line? Or no, not Crossfire, whatever.
Epic moment, right, yes.
Where, you know, he kept pointing out, it's like, I'm a comedy show.
Exactly.
You
know?
I think Tucker Carlson was the conservative on that, just was not, sort of wasn't drawing the kind of distinction that you draw, right, between him, between posing or imposturing. And okay, great. So the fourth chapter, which is about fakes, about fakers. Mm-hmm. So there's an analysis that you develop where it's not only an analysis of what fake news is, which, you know, is very interesting. That's even a deep philosophical question. Mm-hmm, what is fake news? But also you give an account that not only identifies, gives a view of what fake news is, but helps us understand the nature of the problem that fake news poses, which I think are two things that aren't often as deeply connected in the philosophical literature as they need to be. So I appreciated the analysis just for that sort of second order recognition that these two things should be tethered much more tightly than typically are. Can you tell us a little bit about the account of fakery?
Yeah. So as you sort of suggested, I'm not quite so focusing on defining fake news. There's a bunch of really interesting accounts of that, right, that attempt to distinguish it from other terms like propaganda or disinformation or misinformation. And Axel Gelfeld and Andrew Chadwick both have definitions of fake news that I use in the chapter that I think are really helpful. Right. So like Andrew Chadwick, for example, identifies fake news as what he calls the hacking of the hybrid media system. And here I think it's helpful, like this term, the hybrid media system, right, draws our attention to the fact that we're now living in a moment in which the boundaries between old and new media are blurred. It doesn't really make much sense to sort of draw a distinction between traditional offline media and online media. All of these boundaries are blurred right now. So we're dealing with a hybrid media system, and it's being hacked. It's being taken advantage of by various kinds of actors for various kinds of reasons. And so what I really want to do in the chapter is outline why this is such a complicated and serious problem, and one where I think it's really valuable for social epistemologists to be thinking about it. So I identify different sets of causes of this, what I'm calling like the fake news problem, right? And one of the sets of causes is like psychological or cognitive kinds of problems, right? So fakers of various kinds of ilk, right, take advantage of our cognitive heuristics that we often use to sort of evaluate online content. They take advantage of the fact that if we see a message multiple times, we will automatically sort of tend to think that it's more likely to be true, right? So there's really interesting stuff to learn from cognitive psychology about why this is a complicated problem. There's also a host of technological problems of the fake news problem, right? So we can talk about how does search engine autocomplete play into this problem. We can think, and there's been lots of great philosophical literature about filtering algorithms, right? And think about filter bubbles and echo chambers. We can also think about the vulnerability of social media platforms to bots and coordinated attacks that make fake news easier. We can also think about the incentives that are provided by the ad markets that the search engine companies have created and the incentives that they provide for people to create fake news. And there's also a really complicated set of social contexts which are contributing to this problem of fake news, right? So we see the rise of right-wing extremists and hate groups who are coordinating quite sophisticated disinformation campaigns. We can think about problems with media literacy. There's this great essay by Dana Boyd that I really like where she talks about how we've been sort of teaching our students for years to not cite Wikipedia in our papers and instead do research by yourself and Google stuff, right? And the ways in which that kind of media literacy actually maybe has backfired, that right. Wikipedia has all these really interesting sort of social epistemic mechanisms for resisting disinformation campaigns. And actually, Google search engine has actually turned out to be sort of more vulnerable to that, right? And then I also talk about, there's what I call this epistemic double bind facing journalists, where on the one hand, if there's this fake news story out there, they might feel pressure to cover it and have good reason to cover it, but then they're also, right, feeding this sort of repetition of the story. So it's a super complicated problem, and it's one that I think social epistemologists have good reason to think about, right? So if we're thinking about some of the frameworks that I use in the book, right, the most obvious one is often, obviously, veritists are going to be concerned about fake news because it's right. spreading false beliefs and it makes us more liable to that. So this hybrid media system with all of its vulnerabilities to fake news is really epistemically compromised in many ways. But I also sort of build on the argument from the previous chapter about imposters and talk about how fake news is a problem because it's also spreading distrust in our online platforms and our media system, right? So it's very common now and easy to just sort of dunk on the internet. Oh, it's a cesspool. Oh, it's just, you know, a space for misinformation. But I don't want to provide a rosy picture of it, but more a balanced picture. It is also an incredible epistemic tool, right? It enables us to hear about voices that have been previously sort of filtered out through various gatekeepers. It enables marginalized people to often provide an unfiltered account of their own lives and challenge for various dominant narratives. So it's a really sort of an epistemic problem that this fake news problem has caused a lot of people to really distrust our media system, distrust what they read online, right? So I think this sort of spreading distrust is a real serious epistemic problem. But I want to just emphasize quickly, I don't want to also play into sort of these sort of nostalgic narratives that sometimes come up where people right. are like, oh, we, you know, now live in a post-truth world where people no longer believe in the truth and people used to trust these neutral institutions that would tell us the truth, but now we no longer do that. And I think Josh Habgood Coote has really written some yeah. interesting stuff that's been helpful for me on this, right? That, you know, and also Naomi Shemer wrote this beautiful paperback, I think in 2001, it's like Objectivity as Trustworthiness, where she mm-hmm. argued that, right, our institutions have never been neutral, right? Marginalized right. people have always had reasons to distrust the knowledge that is purported to be authoritative and shared, right? And so the media has also never been neutral. So I don't want to argue that, you know, now we're in this problematic field where nobody distrusts and people used to trust. But this is a problem that we need to confront. And I think some of our epistemic tools could be really useful in sort of suggesting things that we could be doing on these fronts.
Great. Yeah, the sort of the nostalgic view of Walter Cronkite is just, yeah. you know, can't possibly be correct.
Exactly. It never was as good as people believe. Some people yeah, believe it was.
That's exactly right. The chapter of the book, the discussion of the book that, you know, struck me as really most sort of engaging and alluring is the chapter on the fifth chapter, which is about online lurkers.
Cool.
You discuss lurking, what lurking is, and you provide an analysis that I think sort of nails it, right? It's a normatively complicated mm-hmm. activity that can be beneficial in certain ways to the lurkers, can be harmful in other ways to the lurkers and to those who are lurked upon. Lurked upon, is that the right word? those who are the object of the lurking.
Yes.
So you develop a conception of virtuous, so this is back mm-hmm. to the second V, mm-hmm. of virtuous lurking activity. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about the phenomena that mm-hmm. Of lurking and some of the normative issues that you address?
Yeah. So, I mean, I identify as a lurker, right? So I read a lot more on the internet. I spent hours on Twitter, I mean, before it started to really go downhill, and Facebook, and now I'm really into TikTok, right? But I don't post as much. I lurk in lots of conversations. So for me, lurking is sort of like regularly reading or viewing online communications of a community without participating in the conversations yourself. So you're lurking, you're consuming. And social media, I think, again, one of the positive features of social media is it provides opportunities for us to learn about people who are different than us, right? And that's particularly important if we think about the epistemologies of ignorance literature, that has showed that often privileged people are unaware of their own biases, their own ignorance, right? That we are liable to socially constructed ignorance of our own privilege. And social media can be a way of combating that, right? I can learn about people, people's lives. I can hear their voices in ways that challenge and help me undo some of my ignorance. And lurking can be a way of doing it. So lurking, I think of as a non-intrusive practice of listening, right? So I can listen to other people. And that's really important because privileged people often have a habit of not being, being intrusive rather than non-intrusive, right? So I think about, you know, that meme of, I don't know if you've seen this, the meme of the Kool-Aid man bursting through the wall and saying, I'm here, right? So often, right, people who purport to be allies, right, or who privileged people often kind of burst into conversations. And to understand this, I draw on a useful term from Shalyn Sullivan she coined ontological expansiveness. So, right. She describes this as a habit of white privilege where white folks are often socialized into feeling entitled to enter spaces. She draws in a story from, I think, Patricia Williams of white folks on a tour of Harlem and feeling entitled to enter a black church and sort of gawk at the people in the church, right? So this—
Yeah, while a service was occurring.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Yeah, we're just on a tour. We're here to watch you, right? So there are ways in which she thinks this is a habit of white privilege that we can be socialized into thinking that we're entitled to enter spaces and enter conversations. And so I draw that to think about, we see lots of examples of this online. So I talk about online ontological expansiveness as all of those moments where we'll see, say, for example, people of color talking about some issue of racism on the internet and white people jumping into the conversation and hijacking the conversation towards their own interests and needs, right? Either feeling defensive and feeling attacked, right? Or even if they're well-intentioned allies, directing the conversation towards, well, how can I be a good ally? How can I help? How does this affect me?
Right. So, sea lioning, right?
Exactly. I just have a question here, right? So that's a kind of ontologically expansive habit that I think we want to avoid as knowers online. Like, we can have virtues of being inquisitive. We can be curious. We can also be, it's a virtue to be open-minded. But when these virtues lead us towards being ontologically expansive, we can actually do harm to online communities. And so lurking can be epistemically beneficial in that it can be this non-intrusive practice of listening. But that said, there are also lots of problems with lurking, right? It's also kind of creepy, right? So it's a creepy kind of objectifying practice in many ways, right? So I draw on Cynthia Townley's paper, I think it's a reevaluation of ignorance, where she develops this account of what she calls the spectator collector mode of knowledge production, where it's kind of an objectifying way of collecting knowledge about somebody or some community. I come, I observe you, I sort of suck up little bits of knowledge from watching you, and then I take it away, right? The spectator collector detached observing mode of watching. And I think lurking can easily be like that, right? So privileged people lurking in spaces for marginalized people can be doing that in an objectifying and voyeuristic way. So one of the things that a virtuous lurker needs to do is to figure out, when am I not wanted in this conversation, right? People often signal, like in blogs, like who this blog is for. And if this blog is not for you, then you should not be lurking in it, right? If this conversation is not for folks like you, right, then a virtuous lurking tells us this is not for me. I need to turn away and respect the integrity of this space. There's also another sort of problem with lurking, is that it can also be a result of kind of a lack of epistemic courage, right? So here I draw on some of Jose Medina's work on epistemic friction as a really useful practice for unlearning our ignorance, right? So I gain epistemic friction when my beliefs and assumptions are challenged, right? I run into this friction with other beliefs and views which challenge my own way of thinking about things, and I can learn stuff from that. Well, if I only lurk and never really talk to marginalized people or people who don't share my identity, I'm not going to have my beliefs and assumptions challenged in the way that's going to generate significant epistemic friction. So sometimes folks need to have the courage to step outside their comfort zone and engage in conversations with people different than them, right? I think a lot of this is what Maria Lagona has talked about in terms of world traveling, like really hanging out with people and getting to know people and living in their worlds. So sometimes lurking can be kind of a cowardly way of avoiding that. So I think being a virtuous person online involves like really using our practical wisdom to think carefully about these questions of, you know, if we think about the, you know, doctrine of the mean, like what's the right amount of courage to use in this situation, right? When to engage, like the virtuous person online engages at the right time, in the right ways, right? In the right, for the right reasons. Tools. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So I need to think about all of these different virtues of open-mindedness, curiosity, trustworthiness, inquisitiveness, right? Open-mindedness, all of these virtues, and I have to figure out how to balance them and do it in ways which are respectful of other people's communities, which help me unlearn some of my ignorance, but not in ways that are going to be destructive of other people's spaces and not going to treat them as mere objects of study for me in a kind of objectifying way.
Right. Very good. Right. And I guess part of it would also have to be to avoid the stance that those conversations and spaces are your resources.
Yes, that they're here for me, not for other people.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. Yeah. Very good. So, you know, Karen, you've been very generous with your time, and I just want to make sure that before we end our discussion today, you know, the book closes with an appendix, and I want to make sure that we have a chance to talk a little bit about this. And the appendix discusses sort of, you know, this is not how you put it, but I hope you'll accept it, normative hazards, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. of internet research as such, almost, right? Mm-hmm. ways in which philosophers and other internet researchers can harm or wrong those persons who form part of the object of their study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, this is a nice segue, this sort of, you know, one way say, is the internet there? Is whatever's happening on the internet, the resource for my research program, can sort of, you know, there's an obvious sense in which the answer is yes, if you're an internet researcher. There's another sense in which that stance, that posture one might take can be normatively problematic mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways. So it turns out that the internet raises sort of distinctive questions that are slightly differently formulated from the standard IRB kinds of questions about the research ethics that are mm-hmm. in play when studying the internet. I thought it was a really nice sort of culmination of the book. So tell us a bit about the appendix.
Yeah, thanks. So I really wrote this to be hopefully helpful to folks in my field, right? So the Association of Internet Researchers has been thinking about ethical guidelines for research for going on 20 years, right? Their first guidelines came out in 2002. And so they're really helpful resources, but there are particular kinds of subsets of those questions that I think come up particularly for philosophers that I wanted to think through myself and to get kind of straight with myself about how I wanted to do this book in an ethical way and maybe help our community think through some of these issues. So the first issue is privacy, right? So we have this often idea of the internet as just like a public square, right? And the people are there, they're tweeting things, and if their account isn't locked, it's just there and I can use that in my research. No problem, right? Philosophers often love to use case studies or use an example. And something that I think can be kind of beguiling about the internet is we don't have to come up with sort of like hypothetical thought experiments. There can often be the perfect tweet there that we can analyze, right? And I think we have to be careful about that. And one of the reasons we have to be careful about that is not only sort of like respecting the privacy expectations of folks, right, who might not be aware that there are researchers out there lurking and reading their tweets, but also think about the issue of context collapse. So this is something that I've written about elsewhere. So context collapse happens when various different contexts are blurred or merged together, right? So somebody might post a tweet thinking that only their followers or some other subset of people are going to see it. But if I reproduce their tweet in my article or my book, it's going to be exposed to a whole bunch of other people that they had no control over and no thought of. And there can be consequences for them. it's particularly important to think about this when we think about marginalized people who are disproportionately targeted for online harassment. We have to really think carefully about folks who are being harassed or might be liable to being harassed, that our scholarship where we quote various kinds of users' tweets or use their social media context in our own research, we can be exposing them to new audiences that might want to engage in coordinated attacks against them. So there's issues of justice here that we have to think about. And so in the appendix, I talk through what are some ways that we can protect privacy of users and people that we want to study. And I talk about my own habits of I just developed a practice that if I wanted to write about somebody and especially marginalized people who might be vulnerable to harassment, I would just reach out to them and I say, hey, here's a copy of this chapter, like a draft I'm working on. Would you be okay if I wrote about your tweet or used your example in this way? And what's nice about that is that it avoids that spectator collector mode of knowledge production, right? I'm engaging with them. I'm taking the participant stance. They can call me out and say, no, you've misrepresented me, right? They are now engaged in the knowledge production with me.
They could just opt out and just say, I don't want, I don't want to be a set piece in this.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And that respects their agency. Right. Yeah. So that's, I think, an important part of internet research ethics and also something that I think is important. So that protects like the targets of our study. But another issue I'd love for our community to also think about is ways that we can also protect researchers. Right. So there's increasingly like harassment of researchers who do public scholarship, and in particular, marginalized people and members of the academy are often targeted for online harassment. And I think as a community, we need to think really carefully about, as we are advising all of these young scholars who want to do applied philosophy, how can we help them develop tools of, you know, basic online security? How can we provide resources for them to protect themselves? But also, how can we educate our deans and the chairs of our departments about how to react if a scholar is attacked for work that they're doing about the internet? And I'll just mention, in case this is useful for you, Bob, or our other folks, right? There's this amazing research paper called Best Practices for Conducting Risky Research and Protecting Yourself from Online Harassment by Alice Marwick, Lindsay Blackwell, and Catherine Lowe. And they actually have fact sheets that you can give to your deans to say, okay, here's what we need to be doing preemptively to protect scholars who might be subject to online harassment. And also here's how we can react if they are attacked. So I think we also need to think as a community of scholars about how we can protect people. And then another set of issues that I want to think about is I also had to confront my own lurking practices, right, as a philosopher, and think about the ways in which I my own positionality, right? So during COVID, I really wanted to hear more and understand better how disabled folks were reacting to COVID, right? How it's shaping their lives. And that challenged some of my own biases or ignorance about that as an able-bodied person. So I'm lurking in these communities. I'm learning a lot from them, right? If in an article I want to cite them or talk about something that I learned from these communities, I mean, I can cite them, I can give them credit, but also think about the fact that a lot of online content creators are not part of the reward system of academia, right? So if I publish a paper, maybe I publish or not, I can get tenure, maybe I can get invited to some fancy conferences and fly around the world to do these things. But a citation for them doesn't mean the same as it does for me. And so I think in the academy, we also need to think about what are ways that we can reorient the resources of the academy to recognize the value that a lot of people on the internet are creating for us as an intellectual community, but we don't have a good reward system for rewarding the kind of intellectual work that they're doing. So I talk about what are things that I try to do as an individual scholar to compensate or support the work of people who I've learned a lot from in doing this work. But that's only sort of individual piecemeal work. We also need to think as a community about how we can restructure the academy in ways that are more just and also use the internet to kind of support the work of content creators who are really part of our intellectual community in these sort of blurred boundaries that we're living with now.
Well, that sounds fabulous. Again, a very nice capstone to a really rich work of philosophy and internet scholarship and much else. So, Karen, we've reached our time, but I want to thank you for joining me for New Books in Philosophy, and more importantly, thank you for writing your book.
Thank you so much, Rob. I really enjoyed our conversation today. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been a real, real pleasure. So let's thank the listeners. Thank you, listeners, for joining our discussion. I've been talking to Karen Frost Arnold. Her new book is published with Oxford University Press. It is titled, Who Should We Be Online? A Social Epistemology for the Internet. It was a pleasure. It was a great pleasure to read. I learned a lot. I recommend it highly. You've been listening to New Books in Philosophy. Bye for now.